Hello, Anthony Fennell here. One of my favourite guests on Future Tense this past year was Ian Bogost. He's a contributor to The Atlantic magazine. He's also a philosopher, game developer, and the author of a terrific book called Play Anything: The Pleasures of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Here he is talking about the true nature of play. It's incorrect, he says, to see play simply as unstructured activity.
Most people, when they think of play, they think it means the opposite of work. It's the thing you get to do when someone's not making you do something. So, you know, the opposite of duty or obligation, that's what play is. You know, now when I'm finally done working, I can go play. And there's a strong association between play and freedom in that conception, that play is, you know, being able not just to do whatever you want in the sense of choosing the domain of your activity, but of kind of acting freely and, you know, just going crazy. But for me, play is almost the opposite. It's very structured and it's working within a set of limitations, a set of very strict boundaries. And those boundaries are set by the thing with which you play. So it could be a guitar. We talk about playing a guitar, or it could be a game, or it could be a situation or an object or even a community that we're not used to thinking about as playable. But that when you think about it, it's just a, you know, matter of manipulation. Like you can work with something. So play is like, this kind of play is like the play that's in a mechanism, like a steering rack in a vehicle, where there's some play that the steering wheel turns through before it engages. And play is a matter of finding those limitations and constraints in things and working within them, seeing what that object can do when you bring something to the table with it.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that you locate play in the other, not in the self, and that we use play to find meaning in tasks.
That's exactly it. We tend to think of play as something that comes from within, that it's an act of creativity and it's a personal act. It's some way in which the individual who plays is kind of overcoming whatever obstacles they face and bringing something new to the table. But for me, I locate play inside of things, like that idea of play in a mechanism. And so the play is already there. The things that it can do are kind of already present in it, whether that's, you know, your commute or your gardening or your relationships or it could be a game or another object, you know, a sport, something that we're familiar with using the word play to describe. And the process of play is that of really entering a relationship with that other thing in which you're treating it with dignity and respect and seriousness, asking, what is possible here? What can I do within the limitations that have been provided? And then how can I carry those out?
Why is play so important for adults?
Well, we tend to think of play as something that is natural to kids and that we have to sort of work for as adults. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that play is not a kind of child's activity, or rather play is a mode of living, or playfulness is a mode of living in which you are constantly aware and relating to the world as one that you can, that you have some control over, but not full control over, and one that you can commune with. And so if you believe that you can commune with things, that there's always something that you can do, you can always figure out a way of working with whatever scenario you find, and then this leads to much better gratification, many more opportunities for gratification and success and pleasure than it would if you only believe that play is a thing that can happen when you do whatever you want, when all of the obligations and duties are left behind. Because really that dream is one that will never be realized. You'll always be kind of waiting for the next thing to end so that something better can come along, and nothing will come along. So instead, living playfully has to be this mode of constant engagement and through which we can achieve a greater contentment.
Now, one of the subtitles of your book is The Uses of Boredom. Many would argue that we're not very productive in addressing the boredom that we encounter in our daily lives. And that, you know, as a result, we give over to our mobile devices because we don't know how to deal with boredom. Do you see play as a way, or this idea of play, as a way of being more constructive with that time?
Right. It's so easy when the moment that we start to feel anxious in any way, bored or just discontent, we have these magic objects in our pockets and purses that we can pull out, our mobile phones, and we can use them to relieve that sensibility. But I think we all also feel that we're not necessarily being gratified, or even that we're being productive when we use those gadgets. We may be looking at email or social media or what have you, but there's also a sense of emptiness that comes with it, and a sense that we are not taking advantage of the world around us. And many folks are wondering, like, how can I spend more time away from my devices, you know, and how can I not feel so attached to them? So boredom is one example of a sensation that when you have it, when you feel yourself growing bored, it's a good sign that you're ready to start doing the real work of figuring out what situation you're in and what you can do about it. And it's exactly at that moment when we tend to give up. We tend to, okay, I'm starting to feel anxious and bored. I'll just look at the phone. And so instead, if you treat boredom not as a symptom of a problem, but as a sign or an opportunity, then when that moment happens, it's clear that, okay, all of the ordinary, kind of obvious stuff that I would think to do as I'm, you know, sitting here in my car, or as I'm, you know, trying to figure out how to manage the kids or the dinner or whatever it is that's going on in your ordinary life or at work, you know, your relationship, your office situation. So those are also scenarios in which you can feel that same kind of anxiety. It's like a flare goes up when you feel bored, and you can stop and say, okay, like I've expended all the obvious ideas. Now I'm ready to get started on finding new ones.
And at that point, a sense of curiosity is also going to be important, isn't it?
There is curiosity at work here, and it's a curiosity that exceeds a return. You know, it's not just curiosity in order that you can get something back from the people or the situations or the objects that you find yourself surrounded by, but just an intrigue in what they are and what they do when you're not looking at them, when you're not working with them. That kind of curiosity actually leads us deeper into this kind of exercise of engaging with stuff, such that, you know, the more that we practice it, the more that we find those feelings of curiosity and let them flourish and culture them, then the more we'll be able to let loose when it really matters. I think a lot of adults, especially, they feel a kind of preposterousness, a kind of foolishness when faced with their natural curiosity, the one that they used to have as children, but then sort of gave up on when just faced with ordinary life, you know, the way that the sidewalk moves around a tree, or, you know, watching a play of light on the windows, you know, those sorts of moments we kind of relegate to the work of poetry in adulthood, and then we immediately dismiss that as not being productive enough to have time for. But in fact, those are the moments that help you see clearly what's happening when it really does matter. And the more that we exercise that muscle again, then the greater we'll be able to put it to use when it matters.
Now, the name of your book is Play Anything, but do you advocate playing everything? Should this sense of play, or this attitude of play as you define it, should that be applied to everything that we do in our lives? Can it be applied to everything we do in our lives?
Maybe not all the time. I guess another way of putting it would be everything is playable. And then the question becomes, you know, what is the right moment to exercise the invitation to play in a particular circumstance? There are some scenarios where, you know, really you have to kind of just toe the line and keep things as they are. And in fact, that is the kind of play that is best, is that of doing what's expected and doing what's already been proven right. And then you also have to be able to recognize, well, you know, we've been doing what we used to do all the time, and now there's time for a change. And that, you know, that could be something in a relationship, it could be something in a business, it could be a political sense of sensibility.
And play doesn't necessarily always mean fun, does it?
It doesn't necessarily mean fun, or at least not fun in the way that we usually mean it, that kind of empty pleasure that is returned to us immediately. Play could be very difficult, and it could lead us toward changes in our lives or our communities that actually are quite hard to bring about, and maybe even trying.
There was a time a couple of years ago when the idea of gamification was enormously popular, particularly in technology circles. The idea that you should try and turn every activity or endeavor into a game, which included rewards and points, etc. That's very different from what you advocate. But looking back, what do you make of that gamification approach?
Well, the thing that gamification got right was the notion that we could bring something from games and from play more broadly, not just to entertainment, but to ordinary life, to work, to all of the tasks that we pursue. The problem is that the way that the gamification advocates go about it is by kind of spreading this sugar coating atop, you know, your job or your workout in order to dole out rewards when you do the right thing and maybe punish you when you do the wrong thing. And once you lick off that sugar coating, very quickly you're faced with exactly the same situation that you had before. So, you know, the gamification tendency is kind of the same as the Mary Poppins logic of, you know, the spoonful of sugar makes the sick tasting medicine go down the throat. But then, you know, once you're done with that initial sense of sweetness that you get from the reward, then you're still faced with the work that you have to do.
And that can lead to cynicism, can't it?
Well, it leads to a sense of immediate disappointment, and then you know, a kind of a rightfully earned bitterness that someone had set you up, in a sense, that instead of showing you what was really happening, what really the work was about, or what really the workout was about, or whatever it is, this is how you engage with it and get better at it, that they were trying to turn it into a lie, to sort of spread this sugar coating atop it and make it seem as though it were something that it wasn't.
Why do you think many of us lose this sense of play? Why is that as we get older?
One thing that we have when we're kids that is harder to recreate when we're adults is a sense that the universe is not designed for us. When you're a child, you're small and you can't do much, and you rely on others. You rely on adults. Everything is above your head. You can't reach it. You have to be picked up to be put somewhere else. You don't have resources of your own or time of your own or the ability to get from place to place. And so, you know, what kids tend to do is they make use of that world. They recognize that it is not designed for their contentment, that in fact they have to work harder in order to get something back from it. But then once we grow up, we have more and more control over. We sometimes feel out of control, but we have much more ability to kind of make an effort that leads to results that we can see. And so we develop a sense that we're entitled to something like that, that the universe is here to give us something back, rather than to recognize that neither is the world out to get us, nor is it designed for us in particular. And so that kind of humility, that sense of humility and smallness, that's what we have when we're kids that we lose when we're adults, not the sense of play.
Just a final question. What was the impetus for you for writing this book, for trying to explain to the broader public out there your notion of play and why it's important?
As someone who's been designing and studying games and the history of games and play for a long time, you know, I watched the gamification trend and other ways that the general public have tried to make use of games and play in a way that is productive and beneficial. And it's always seemed slightly wrong to me. There seems like there's the power of games and of play was stranger, not darker, really brighter, but also more powerful and more generally applicable than we'd given it credit for. And so I've been looking for a way to give that some light, to make it clear that the thing that's most useful about games is not that they're this kind of dark, you know, addictive pastime that puts us in basements committing violence against avatars, but that games are very good at getting people to deliberately and clearly see the natural or artificial limits of things. And that's really the sensibility that we want to transfer out of them, that games and play have something to teach us about approaching people and things and places and situations and taking them for what they are, rather than lamenting that they're not something different from what they are. And that seemed like a lesson that was worthy to bring outside of that community into the general public.
Philosopher, game developer, and author of the book Play Anything, Ian Bogost. Nothing like a bit of guilt relief for the summer season. I'm Anthony Fennell. Now, you heard what Ian had to say, so get out there and play.